I'd like to tell you a little bit about the isolated neutron star that Walter discovered, and he talked about it already in the conference we had, and specifically then about its cometary H-alpha nebula that we found around that. I did this together with Sri, although he has done so little so far, and I know that this is recorded, but I don't know if he will be on it for long. But he still has a chance. So let me just remind you, because I always thought this sort of a neat thing. I mean, of course, Bob talked about isolated neutron stars, and people thought there would be many, but then not really, because many neutron stars have high velocities, and they don't really accrete as much as we expected, I think. But it's sort of interesting to think that people thought of finding 1,000 or so in the Rosetta All Sky Survey, didn't find anyone, and then had to wait for someone to find actually a very bright source by coincidence. And this is Walter's images in which he found this isolated neutron star. And it was aimed at this little star formation region. And you see several of these stars, which are forming stars, have nice X-ray counterparts. And he could identify all of those as optical. With optical stars, but not this one, which is the brightest by far in this image. It's about 3 counts per second. And it did not have an optical counterpart. Now, I guess the story became one of press releases from that moment on, but oops. So he did find it then later with HST. It's this little object here, and here the red one is the red band, and the blue color is an ultraviolet band, and this one is sort of white, which in this scaling indicates it's hot. All the other stars are cool. So that's sort of said that this thing really is a neutron star. And in fact, the X-ray 2 optical spectral energy distribution is actually fairly like a black body. In fact, so much so that it can't have just a pure hydrogen or helium atmosphere. It must have some source of real opacity, and the temperature is about 600,000 Kelvin or 50 eV or so. Now, why is this source so interesting? I guess there's the astronomical interest in just what kind of source is this? Is this finally one of these accreting neutron stars, an old neutron star with no magnetic field anymore, just going through space, happening across dense regions once in a while, and then getting reheated? Or is it not? Well, I think that is actually, well, that's an interesting question. I think the much more interesting question is, can we use it to learn something about the structure of neutron stars? And what makes it so good is that is this really thermal spectrum from optical to X-ray wavelengths. And that means that you might hope that you could just do a model atmosphere fit and like one does for other stars and for white dwarfs, and infer the effective temperature, the surface gravity, as for other stars, but in addition, for a neutron star, also the gravitational redshift, which, because it's of order 0.3, is not messed up. I mean, in principle, you could do this for any star. In fact, it's a measurable quantity for any star. Well, not any, but for a star like the Sun, it's measurable. But mostly, of course, you don't know the radial velocity, which messes you up. But if your gravitational redshift is already 0.3, then that is not so much of an issue. Now, and that would give you, if you also have the distance, which in this case we do, give you a radius. This would affect the temperature, would give you a radius. The gravitational redshift would give you m over r, and the surface gravity would give you m over r squared. So you actually, even an overdetermined, and this is just in principle, of course, solution for mass and radius of the neutron star, and this would mean we would finally have some clue what the equation of state of matter inside neutron stars actually is like. Now, there is the problem sort of more in general, if one wants to apply this to neutron stars, is it actually is the emission thermal, and this is one of the best cases. Most other neutron stars, you have either magnetospheric emission, as in radio pulses, or you're messed up by accretion. And the next question that one would what one needs in order to do this analysis, at least these two parts, is actually have lines in the spectrum. And in this case, in principle, for a neutron star, one might worry that the hydrogen will just flow to the surface, and then you wouldn't have any lines for such a hot neutron star. But we already know from the shape of the spectrum that it's not pure hydrogen or pure helium at least unless there's a very strong magnetic field. So this is actually, as we heard on the HAT meeting, the X-ray spectrum actually shows, from Chanda, the first spectrum, shows at least hints of lines, although the signal to noise is not really good enough to be very sure. So this is probably okay too. Now then the third point is actually, okay, supposing this is all good, do we actually understand atoms under high pressure? I think the answer is no, not even hydrogen. That is a slight problem, but I'm being sort of mostly an observer, I sort of feel that problem will be solved the moment we actually have good spectra to work on. There's just no real, I mean, there is interest in it, but no real strong interest, I would say. It's sort of boring atomic physics, very, very complicated, and maybe not, not really what you think you would make your career on if you wouldn't actually use it then to infer something perhaps more fundamental.
How high is the high pressure where it matters?
The surface, let's see, the density is
about, the density, sure.
Yeah, the density is a few 10 to the 23rd in the photosphere. And the temperature is about 600,000 Kelvin. Yeah, the surface gravity, maybe I should give you that number too, it's 10 to the 14 and a half approximately. So it is a high gravity. And then the last question, of course, and that's the sort of worry one always has, is will there be other effects we are ignoring, especially magnetic fields, which we know occur in neutron stars. And perhaps if it rotates very fast, that's actually a source of broadening, which would also mess up this part, at least. And in fact, if it rotates very fast, it even messes up this one because of second-order Doppler shift. I should say that from the six sources we know, four of them actually show pulsations. So I would say that this is actually pretty strong evidence that, three of them show pulsations, that they have magnetic fields. One of them with a spin down rate which indicates a magnetic field of about 10 to the 15 Gauss. So, of course, it's not clear then what the other three are, if they are just aligned and they also have such strong magnetic fields, or if they're just different objects. In any case, I think no matter what, this, given that this is the brightest one, you would just like to study it as much as possible with the idea that, hopefully you can learn something about the neutron star. Now, when I got in, this was maybe a little bit late. The X-ray spectra were already being taken in guaranteed time observations, so I had little way of getting in there. The Far UV spectrum was already being taken by Walter. We also realized that this might be an option. So what's left is the optical wavelength range. So that's what I proposed to do. And not that I really expected all that much, I have to admit. But on the other hand, this is a new source. You should not be too biased by expectations. So we tried to get a spectrum at the VLT, which is slightly challenging because the source is only 25th and a half in V. So just let me show you how we actually went about it, because the problem if the source is that small is how are you sure that it's going to be in the slit? This is not a very, but I thought it was not too difficult. But basically what we did, we always set up the slit on a bright star and then oriented the slit such that from the HST image we knew it would land up in the slit. Now when one of the things you learn when you're an observer is never really trust anything. So I did take an image before we started our first long integration in this slit, just to see whether everything was actually okay. And to our surprise, we didn't actually find the source at the position it should be. There was only this very little faint blob, just a little bit off from it. And my night assistant says, well, if that's the source, then you might as well give up your night now. This is useless. This is so faint, you won't see anything in the spectrum. Well, I was not that quick to give up. And I sort of wondered, has this thing moved? And then when we read out the spectrum, it turned out there was actually a trace, which was very, very blue, and so we still were getting some counts. But the source had, in fact, moved, but it had managed to move exactly along the slit, which was very kind of it. So that was very good. We didn't lose any time on that. And then, of course, later, I mean, that has... there was, in the contest of the press releases, Walter had this press release from HST. He had been also measuring the proper motion and mostly tried to get the parallax, which he succeeded in. And so you see that this source really moves with time. It moves pretty fast, in fact, a third of an arc second. Now, the interesting thing, and that is what he talked about also at the conference, is that you, if you just put this proper motion and sort of see where this source might have come from, you find that its trace on the sky could cross, if depending on the radial velocity, through an OB association in Upper Scorpius. If you assume that the source came from there, it's about 1 million years old, and then it obviously would not be an accreting, or at least likely not be an accreting source. I should actually warn you that that number also depends pretty strongly on the distance that he takes. If you take into account uncertainty in that number, you get a pretty large uncertainty in that age. But that has been corrected. I mean, if you look at the latest version, Gino Bandiera noticed that, I think, he basically didn't correct for the motion of the sun or something like that. I'm not completely sure, but anyway, that has been corrected in this version. And in fact, Walter gives a little table of, depending on the distance, how long will it have been since it came there. So you can see for yourself. Okay, so that was very nice to have a distance to it and a proper motion. And then, of course, okay, we got the spectrum. Let me just show you that because it's rather boring and then I can go on. So this is the optical part of the spectrum. These black things are the HST photometric points. And this red dot is my optical spectrum, which sort of, and then this blue line is a Rayleigh Jeans tail with a slight bit of absorption. And you see that basically the points follow very nicely along that line. It doesn't really look like there's anything significant there. In fact, if I just fit a Rayleigh Jeans tail to my optical spectrum alone, I get a reduced chi-square of 1.1. So there's not that much more than that. Sad, but not exactly unexpected. Okay, so now let me get to the second surprise. The first was the proper motion, obviously. And that is that there were no features in the spectrum of the source, but there did seem to be a few emission lines, which when I inspected the images better, was clear that they were coming from near the neutron star rather than just from the star itself. And that you can see here. So this little thing is the spectral image, where this is the spatial direction here along the slit, and this is wavelength. And you see, and here's the same for this slit, you see there's a little bit of H-alpha emission here, and this is a crosscut through it. It's extended compared to the spatial profile you would expect from this star. So across from the proper motion, it's just extended, and the nice thing is that along the proper motion, you actually see it has a very long tail, so trailing the neutron star. So that was sort of very intriguing. What is happening there? Now the first thing, there's really two options. One would be that, like many neutron stars, it's a bow shock. But the other option is, couldn't it just be due to the ionization of the interstellar medium by this very hot neutron star? Now I must say that at this point I was blatantly unaware of that fact that Omar Blaise had actually calculated this very explicitly, and in fact that there was a Russian paper, now, God, I forgot the name already, Schwarzman, from 1971, who considered this as a way of finding neutron stars. It's sort of rather the reverse, that they might ionize the interstellar matter, and you would have these little nebula around them. This is sort of a warning, I guess. The reason why I was unaware of this is that since there were clearly so many fewer isolated neutron stars than these guys had predicted, it was obviously that what they had done was wrong. So I didn't have to read it, I thought. And this is where you clearly have to be careful. There might still be good ideas in there, after all. So this is all my fault. No, this is, I'm not putting this as critique on you, I'm putting it as critique on myself. So what do you have to do to see if ionization is actually important? I mean, this bow shock, we can't really do many calculations on because we don't see any evidence that this thing is actually a pulsar, so we don't know anything about it. So let's first look if we could just understand it based on what we do know. So what you need is to know, first of all, how efficient this thing is in ionizing this, and for that you need to know the cross-section. So let me just show that, because this is a much higher source, so in many places you'll find you have to think, if you know anything about ionization nebula, you have to think a little bit differently for this source than for like a hot white dwarf or an OB star or so. This is a much harder source to start with. So here's again wavelength. This is the Planck function in photon numbers. And this is the cross section for hydrogen ionization. So you have this big jump at the Lyman edge and then it falls off of 1 over nu cubed. And this is the two multiplied to each other. So you have, you know, the thing to note here is that there's that your effective wavelength for energy will actually be quite low, or high energy, and typically a pretty high energy photon will ionize a hydrogen atom, and the cross section is fairly small. So this is for this black body of 50 eV. So if you're supposing you're a little hydrogen atom and you're being approached by this neutron star, when would you really start to notice the fact that this thing is sending out these horribly energetic photons and actually is trying to get you to lose your electron? So we can just calculate the timescales that are important in this nebula. So again, here's for this temperature, and if I now scale the flux, for this temperature, I have this cross-section, sort of average cross-section. And the number of photons that I would have on Earth, I can derive by just insisting that the black body, that 50 eV black body, goes through, the measured B-band flux from HSD. And that means that on Earth, if there were no intervening absorptions, there would be 0.4 photons arriving, which could ionize hydrogen at all per second per square centimeter. So with that, we can calculate the ionization time. It's nothing else than just the number of X-ray photons being emitted divided by the distance at which my little test particle is, and then times the cross-section, and then to the minus 1. And you would really like to have that in observables. So you divide this by 4 pi d squared, and then this becomes an angular size on the sky, and this is the observed number of photons, or the inferred rather, with the cross-section, and that turns out to be 13 years. Now compare that to the crossing time. Okay, so I've used that the nebula is about 1 arc second in front of the neutron star. Compare that with the crossing time through this nebula, and this neutron star is going at a third of an arc second per year, so the crossing time is about 3 years. That is sort of the same order, so that sounds pretty good. In principle, it looks like the nebula is emitting where you expect it to become ionized, so that's good. Now, if you then look at the recombination time, which would tell you how long this nebula could be emitting, here we don't yet know the electron density, but if you take the recombination rate, which for a typical temperature of 10,000 Kelvin, which turns out to be not so right, but anyway, this number is not so uncertain. It's about a few times 10 to the minus 13. Then you get that the recombination time is 10 to the 5 years for an electron density of 1. And you see that you have to have ridiculous electron densities to make this equal. So you in fact do expect that the matter gets ionized and then stays ionized for a very long time behind it. So you do expect a tail. Now at first I must say I thought this whole nebula might be due to recombination, and then you, from the H-alpha flux, you can infer Ne, which was about 100 or so, which seemed nice because then you could power the source by accretion, but I now realize that this was rather naive of me. So that is not true, but I'm just sort of, that was in the press release, so that's why I mentioned it. Then the final thing one wonders about by calculating all these quantities, well, is actually the optical depth to this ionization point, is that low enough that this estimate is realistic? I'm ignoring the optical depth here. Well, you can calculate the optical depth, and again, that is very, very small, unless the interstellar matter is ridiculously dense. Now that means, and that has all been, that had been done, in fact, by several people already, including Omar here, is that you can calculate very simply what the ionization structure of this nebula will be. So in general, if for a little parcel of matter which has a neutron star coming at it, the number of ionized hydrogen atoms will increase with time by the number of ionizations, which is again set by the number of photons passing through the time and an optical depth, and then it will decrease in time because of recombinations. And now we know that this one is unimportant, we know this one is unimportant. So we get actually very simple expression, where if I now divide by N0 here, so that I just have the fractional ionization, I get this expression, which I won't go through that, but you can simply solve it analytically. And the scale that comes in is this Z0, which so depends on the number of ionizing photons and the cross-section, so the effective number of absorbed photons at any place, and the velocity of the neutron star, so how quick it is zooming through there. And the solution looks like this. So if the neutron star is moving this way, then you will have something which iso-ionization fraction contours will look like this. And say perpendicular to this, you get something which falls off like this, as 1 over r at the end, which is logical because you've integrated something which goes as 1 over r squared over a whole path. So it will be 1 over r. Now, if this were the end of the story, and if indeed this nebula was due to recombination, you would expect something like this. So it should look like this, basically. This is in units of this Z0. Matter becomes ionized and then starts to emit, and it hardly recombines, so it's sort of continuous emitting, and it increases here towards the back because of these. This is an integration over all over this circularly axisymmetric thing, because there's more and more stuff further out, which is also reasonably ionized. Now this, it first seemed not too bad, except that the emission here peaks definitely behind the neutron star rather than at the neutron star, what we observed. But so in general, I thought, oh well, you will get this kind of tail, and this is also what it looked like in Omer's papers. So in order to see if this tail was really there, we proposed again for observations, now just to take an image in H alpha. And that was our press release, so this is the third one. And that is seen here. So of course we always need nice little colored pictures. So what is here is the blue color in this image is actually blue. The red band that we had to, in order to have something to subtract from the H alpha to get rid of continuum emission, I've made that green, and then H alpha itself is red. So this is the neutron star, which is sort of purplish, and this is the little, very faint nebula. I should perhaps tell you that this is 5.5 hours of integration in H alpha. So this nebula is really not very bright. And of course, this doesn't look at all like the picture I just showed you with this nice little solid tail. In fact, this looks quite a bit like a Bauschock, which may just mean that is it. But I sort of, I mean, I really didn't like, well, I must say, in some sense, I'm really biased. I don't want this thing to be a pulsar, because then that means I can't do anything on what I really want, which is getting the neutron star properties. So I mean, you have to keep that a little bit in mind during the rest of the talk. I must say that the one sort of more general thing is that I really don't like the idea that, okay, we observe something new, now we have to invoke this pulsar wind, and this fact that this source is a pulsar for which we see no evidence whatsoever otherwise. It's sort of unpleasant to me. I don't like this new fact, new hypothesis type of work. I mean, that may still mean it's true. And then the third thing is this really then just a coincidence that this ionization time is quite, oh, really of the same order as the crossing time. So have we been forgetting something? And this is then where I can actually include Omer. That is sort of nice. There's still other things I was forgetting which he wasn't. But what about the effect? I talked only about the ionization, but I mean, what actually happens when you ionize this thing is you have this 30 eV photons. Okay, they ionize a hydrogen, so 13.6 eV is lost, but that still means there's some almost 20 eV just left. What happens with that? Well, that means that is going to heat a gas. And in fact, by the time, if you think of pure hydrogen, by the time it's completely ionized, the temperature is almost 70,000 Kelvin. Well, the common interstellar medium is maybe 100 or so. So what would this gas do? Well, obviously, actually, in hindsight, it would just expand. So might that not explain why this nebula is not just a straight tail, but actually something which is widening there? Now, I had some worry, because really you would then expect this cone to be completely filled with ionized gas and maybe emit rather uniformly. And this thing is not so easy to see here, but it really is relatively hollow. So it's not clear that you could get that. Now, given this temperature, one thing which is clear is that recombination is not going to dominate. Collisions, by the time you're not yet fully ionized, between relatively, say, 30,000 Kelvin or 40,000 Kelvin, the collisions between fast electrons and those neutral hydrogen atoms that are still neutral will excite a neutral hydrogen, and that may actually lead to H-alpha emission too, and much more efficiently so than recombination. Okay, so let me just go back again to what you would expect for the emission if you include collisions, but do not yet include cooling. It will come in a moment. And also, one other thing which I learned while talking to people here, really I should take into account helium, because in fact, the cross-sections for helium, even though it's a relatively small abundance, the cross-sections are fairly high, because, well, there's more photons at higher energies. And also, the photons that ionize the helium are actually even more energetic, and although the ionization potential is also larger, it still means that for every little ionization of helium that you put in, you get 30 eV out rather than just 18 for the hydrogen. In any case, it's sort of not so very important. Maybe you should just look at the red curves, which are for hydrogen only. So here again is the ionization fraction, which just goes up. This is not at the neutron star, but a little bit above it for a path. So as you pass the neutron star, the ionization fraction goes up. The temperature indeed rises to a high value, about 60,000 Kelvin. And this is then the H-alpha rate from collisional excitation, which actually peaks more or less at the neutron star and then decreases, because there are fewer and fewer neutral hydrogen atoms left here to excite. So that already helps a little bit to make this, to start making this cone hollow. And now I should tell you that the recombination, the rate from recombinations with this density is 3.5 particles per cubic centimeter. The recombination flux from H alpha would be about 10 to the minus 12. So it's really utterly irrelevant. Now, in fact, this number of excitations is so high that it is important for the cooling of this gas. And in fact, one should also take into account the collisional ionizations. And this all had been done by Omer already. But
Mark, I hate to interrupt, but there's a couple of things that it seems that you could do. For one, when you know the length of, you know the velocity of the pulsar, presumably, you
yes.
know the length of the Bose shock, you can, so you know when it has to recombine, so you should be able to calculate when the...
Yeah, but like I said, the recombination time, I mean, that doesn't change. It's 10 to the fifth year. It doesn't recombine for all practical purposes. Mm-hmm. It's just that the recombination radiation is so irrelevant. We can't see that at all. We only see this source as long as it's hot enough to have collisional excitations, and as long as there's neutral hydrogen around. So let me just show you what happens if you also include the cooling from this and the collisional ionization. So again, just focus on the red lines. That makes life a little bit easier. Here's the ionized fraction. That doesn't change so much. Now, the temperature tries to get up, but as it is approaching 40,000 Kelvin, the cooling really starts to hit it, and it actually decreases again. And that also makes that you can't see that really here, that the ionized fraction is, in fact, higher than it was in the previous plot. It also makes a big difference to the H-alpha photon rate. It rises up almost as quick at the start, but then gets quenched because matter gets completely ionized and the temperature drops too.
So what cooling are you actually using?
So cooling by collisional excitation and collisional ionization.
Collisional excitation of
hydrogen. In this case, the red curves are still on for pure pure hydrogen. In fact, for the helium collisional excitation and ionization won't matter at all.
So what are you doing with the Lyman alpha?
This is for case B, so I'm assuming that Lyman alpha... Oh, no, I do include it in the cooling. I assume that that diffuses out. But the actual... I do take here that every time you excite the NH3 level, mm-hmm. that you never... Your Lyman betas at some point will be reprocessed in an H-alpha and a Lyman alpha. So in that sense, this is case B. So this may be a slight overestimate of the production.
But the neutral column is fairly high.
Yes.
I mean, does the Lyman alpha really get absorbed, or does it escape?
I think it will sort of scatter around until it gets absorbed by something else, right?
Well, yes. that's the story if you have a sufficiently high column.
That's right.
On the other hand, this is a very tenuous region.
Yeah, it's not that's true. The let me think now. The column in Lyman alpha was only. I think of 50 or so. The optical depth through, say, 1 arc second was only about 50. So it's substantial. Then with Lyman beta, one might really start to wonder, because I think it's 10 or even less, and Lyman gamma would obviously almost be optically thin, at least through the nebula. So I don't think this is a major issue. Now, so this was actually one of the notes I wanted to make here before going on, is that I assumed case B in this, so that may be a slight overestimate of the H-alpha photon rate. I also assumed that metals were not important in cooling this thing earlier. I think that is fair enough, actually. And then my third note is that I'm still ignoring the expansion that I told you would be so important. And I don't really, I mean, maybe it's possible to do that analytically. I would actually, given the results that I got from the simulation, I think so, but I don't yet know how. What I did in order to see what this expansion would be is I downloaded Zeus from the web, and I just want to have a little rave about it, because I really think it's pretty fantastic that people just make this available and that it's actually very easy to use. It's amazing. I had to change it a little bit in order to, because in principle it only keeps track of density and internal energy and then the velocity fields. And so I had to change it a little bit so that I could keep track of ionized fractions. But basically, that was relatively easy. And the whole thing is just, I think it's very, very nice. And so good that you don't have to write it yourself, of course. Okay, so this is the result of my simulation. And let me just also first point out what I put in. So I have 3.5 nucleons per cubic centimeter with this helium abundance. The temperature of 50 eV, the neutron star radius I put in because that basically sets the total number of ionizing photons that one has, and then the neutron star velocity, and this is for this distance of 60 parsec that Walter et al. Inferred from their parallax. So what are you seeing here? These three panels are all the fractions of the different ions. So this is the fraction of neutral hydrogen over the total amount of hydrogen that we have. So black is where it's mostly neutral, and you see that here close to the neutron star it becomes completely ionized. This is neutral helium over total helium, so that gets indeed ionized a bit earlier because it has actually a bigger cross-section. And then this is the fractional abundance of helium-2. So you have a region where helium-2 is more dominant, but then close to the neutron star and behind it, helium is also completely ionized. So these two panels show the velocity that matter is getting because of the heating. And so this is the velocity in this direction. And the fact that it's white here means that matter close to the neutron star is trying to go with the neutron star, because behind it has this really hot stuff. So it's being pushed towards the cool stuff. But it's not very fast. It's about 5 kilometers per second or so. And then this is a velocity in the radial direction. And so this is all moving outward with a velocity of about 10 kilometers per second. And then finally on the right, this is the density. So you see here that this indeed behind the neutron star, there is this region which is being evacuated because of the expansion. And this is the temperature. And again, the region behind the neutron star is completely ionized, so there's no cooling there, or hardly any cooling. And here things get hotter as the ionization increases. And then there's maybe some more complicated stuff. So here then finally is, this is the expected collisional rate producing H-alpha photons. So that looks like this. So you suddenly see that you have this shape which really has very little behind the neutron star. First of all, because all matter is ionized, so there is no neutral hydrogen to collide with. And also then this expansion, you can really see that this, the reason I thought it might be able possible to do it analytically is that this looks it looks sort of like a very easy shape. But maybe that's what you would get anyway. And so that you see back here too, that really, if you were to ignore the expansion, this very dark bit would just go on along this axis. But the expansion really shuts that off. And then this finally is when you integrate it over all angles. And this is how you would observe it for an inclination of 60 degrees. So how does this compare with my observations? Now I guess tell you that basically there's two things that really matter. The combination of these two is basically the total number of photons that you actually emit. So that sets the size scale of everything. And then the density sets the brightness of the nebula. So this is, again, these H-alpha traces I had from my spectra. In some sense, they're actually easier to deal with than the picture. So this is H-alpha, and then here's H-beta for comparison. For very high temperature, you would expect H-alpha and H-beta to have roughly a 3-to-1 ratio, as you get for recombination. And for somewhat lower temperatures, you do not expect to excite H-beta as much as H-alpha. So it should be lower than 3, but as you can see, it will be pretty hard to be very quantitative about that. Any case, this is the solid line is then the model, the observation of my model, I guess. And as you see, it sort of works reasonably well. It's a little bit, the tail is really not quite long enough. It's sort of, there's still H-alpha emission when my model would not predict many anymore. And then for the cross direction, that was sort of neat, because in fact at the neutron star there's so little emission, there's a small little dip in there. And I mean, without the model I would never have said the observations show that, but it is funny that in fact the observations do show a dip near the neutron star. So that's sort of cute.
Wait, which way is
it? This is along the proper motion, and this is across the proper motion, because I have these two spectra.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that inclination that you've chosen agrees with the association with the obvious.
Yeah, that would actually be roughly okay. I haven't really.
That wasn't a free parameter. That was a.
I consider it a free parameter, but with the 60 degrees, it would be okay. But really, it's not. I have been trying only a little bit. It's not very sensitive unless you make it say less than 30. Then it really starts to matter. Okay, well, we can do a little bit better here. This is in a real. The observer, I guess, wants to model his data, and in the end, if you take an image, you want to just subtract everything and be left with noise only. So let's take our H-alpha Bauschock here. In this image, I should say, I've subtracted the R-band image scaled such that it, as best as possible, removed stars. You see that is not all that good. Now, here's my model, and here is the H-alpha image minus my model. And you see sort of the same thing, actually, if you look very close. I mean, this sort of looks noisy. That really, at somewhat larger distances, it doesn't quite subtract enough, and perhaps a little bit too much in the front. So I think, actually, it's easier to work with these slit spectra, because there, at least, I really know what the errors are.
What's the 60 parsecs? What's the physical scale across?
Okay, so at 60 parsec, 1 arc second is 10 to the 15 centimeter, and that is roughly this distance. So from the...
AU.
60 AU, right?
AU, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. So this way is how many arc seconds across?
So in front is about 1 arc second, and I guess here sort of 2 arc seconds in both directions, say 4 arc seconds in total. Right. Yeah.
So in terms of the ISM, there are fluctuations on those scales. I don't remember the amplitude.
Yeah, okay, so you mentioned that briefly. You can sort of see that in fact this side of the nebula is observed to be brighter than this side. So there are... There are obviously some fluctuations.
You're at 100 AU scale.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So, what are my conclusions? if this nebula is due to ionization, which well, I think is at least not unreasonable, this is actually sort of new type of nebula. This is one thing which I we tried to think last night at some point. Is there any other source where really it's recombination is utterly irrelevant? Actually, in some sense, cooling is not too important. At least it's just you get ionized and you collide and you expand and that's it. And most other nebulas have sort of an ionization front. This doesn't really. So that's sort of cute. Then what we learned from that is that the density of the interstellar matter is some 3 or 4 nuclei per cubic centimeter, which is slightly higher than the normal ISM, but just from the column density you find on average in this line of sight, it's 1, and so it's not that bad to be a little bit above that. And we also, of course, measure the actual number of X-ray, of ionizing photons that are emitted. And I need about 0.8 for this 50 eV temperature. Again, I have not really played around with that a lot. And so this is about twice the black what you would expect from a black body extrapolation from the optical. So either this tells us that this model is wrong, or it just tells us that this neutron star is emitting a bit more in this wavelength region. And I think that is a measurement you could not do in any other way. Now, if it is a Bove shock, I mean, this is really where Sri comes in. He was supposed to calculate that. then you your energy loss from the pulsar is a free parameter, basically. But no matter what, you will find, I mean, that we checked already, you will find, again, a very low density. So one conclusion definitely is this source is not currently powered by accretion. It is hot. Well, maybe just because it was born a million years ago or a bit less, or perhaps because it went through a denser patch, and we shouldn't be completely certain about the association yet. But I would say that's the most likely. Okay, so thanks very much.
So Reno actually did, as you know, spend a lot of time thinking about the Bauschat model, but he never actually communicated a surface brightness profile to you.
No, he didn't.
I see.
Okay. Yeah, well. And I should perhaps say that actually if you just fed this analytic Bauschat shape from Franz Wilken, it actually fits very, very well. On the other hand, that Bauschat shape assumes, the assumption in there is that only the momentum is important, that in the interaction between the wind and the interstellar matter, you instantly lose all your energy, and that obviously cannot be true. So I'm not so sure that is actually the relevant one to use.
So if you take 10 to the 9 of these, can you warm the interstellar medium substantially with this?
Well, the thing is, why would they all be so hot? So hot then?
Neutron stars. We have one. It's hot. Multiply by 10 to the 9.
Well, this is in fact, if you reach this paper by Schwarzman, this is one of the questions he asked, whether one could keep the ionization rate of the interstellar medium high enough with these things. I think basically the answer is we know they're not 10 to the 9 of these hot neutron stars. We would have seen them. That's the whole calculation, right? Surely there will be some more, but not 10 to the 9.
They don't stay hot for 10 to the 9 years.
Sorry?
If it's hot because it's cooling.
Yeah, it won't stay hot that long. Yeah. And this is but I guess Bob was referring, well, maybe they just get hot for reasons we don't quite understand, which is a fair enough supposition to make, but I would say observationally that's excluded, well, from your work for one. But
you can calculate whether cooling neutron stars are sufficient to keep the H-alpha emission from the extended H-alpha emission going, and they're not.
No, I mean, but in some sense, right, we see so many of these very hot horizontal branch and stars and white dwarfs. They're bound to be more important. They have many more photons. The thing that makes this star so weird is, in some sense, it has actually very few photons, but they're very hard, and that makes this whole nebula look very different from what you normally get.
So, have you, out of those calculations, is there any subsidiary things you can predict that will allow you to go make an observation.
Well, the one thing is actually that I think that in the tail you would not expect H beta to be present at all. And at some point the temperature just becomes too low for that. Well, there would still be H alpha. Well, the other thing, no, the real prediction, I would think, is go to other sources. I mean, that's my feeling.
Well, one thing you might try to work out is whether or not the Lyman alpha that you're assuming in case B4 is actually absorbed by dust and would have any traceable infrared radiation.
That's a good point, yeah. Although, I mean, I'm a little bit, it probably would, well, yeah, I mean, since I needed 5.5 hours, I mean, don't forget that on one of the larger telescopes we have right now, to even detect this H-alpha nebula, I don't think there's anything in the infrared which would be, you know, obviously you have more Lyman alpha, a lot more, but.
Right, and if you've got more Lyman alpha, that's all coming out. I mean, assuming the Lyman alpha is trapped, it's basically scattering around.
Right, until it gets absorbed, yeah.
Radio.
No, it's just that most infrared instrumentation is not exactly really sensitive. I'm just a bit worried we would need an 8-meter, well, we would need maybe NGST, who knows.
Will you do this with the other six candidates?
Well, this is, she has been thinking for a long time to buy an H-alpha filter for Keck, and I think we have even better reasons to do this and go after them. Yeah. It would make a lot of sense to do that.
This discrepancy with the number of ionizing filters, did you take into account, I can't remember whether this is important or not, and it's not least important, but did you take into account secondary ionization?
Yeah, I looked at it. It's, well, this is one of the things, I haven't done this, I'm not so used to it, so I really should go through all my numbers, but it seemed to me that the moment you're ionized a little bit, the secondary electrons become very unimportant, because they just get thermalized sooner than they hit a neutral particle.
Martin, what was the distance again of this?
60 parsec is what he gets. So there are, again, think of uncertainties, right? 100 parsec is only 2 sigma away from that. It's, this is to be improved, I would say.
Great, okay, thanks, Martin.